The music of Andrew Frank, Points of Departure, performed by the Earplay Unit. That's it. Happy Monday to you. This is WORT in Madison, and after the news, it's Brian Standing in the 8 o'clock buzz.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Several defence officials in Gaza say Israel has struck two areas in the southern city of Rafah, where the IDF has told civilians to leave. Palestinian media have shown thick plumes of smoke rising over buildings as displaced Palestinians carrying what's left of their belongings flee eastern Rafah. Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinians quickly packed up their possessions and crammed into cars and onto donkey carts after Israeli flyers began dropping, instructing them to leave. The Israeli military is directing them to two tent cities, which Gazans say are already crowded with displaced people. An Israeli army spokesman said that the operation planned in eastern Rafah was of a limited scope, but a Hamas official said that the evacuation orders, which have already been followed by Israeli airstrikes, were a dangerous escalation. Israel has said that victory over Hamas in Gaza is impossible without taking Rafah.
President Vladimir Putin has ordered tactical nuclear weapons drills near Ukraine in response to what Russia called Western threats to deploy troops there. The Kremlin said this was a response to statements by Paris and London. Ukraine said the drills were a continuation of Moscow's nuclear blackmail. Russia has repeatedly made veiled nuclear threats to deter Western support for Ukraine as it resists the invasion. The war in Ukraine was high on the agenda of Paris talks involving China's President Xi Jinping, President Macron and the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. She called on Beijing to show more effort in curtailing deliveries of dual-use goods to Russia that turn up on the battlefields of Ukraine. She said the issue affected Brussels' relations with China, given the war's existential threat to Ukraine and the European continent.
We agree that Europe and China have a shared interest in peace and security. We count on China to use all its influence on Russia to end Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine.
Mr. Xi urged the EU to remain committed to a mutual partnership. Brussels says it intends to abandon infringement proceedings against Poland for alleged breaches of the rule of law. The dispute began when Poland's previous right-wing government introduced sweeping changes to the judiciary. Here's Adam Easton.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the decision marked a new chapter for Poland. She congratulated Prime Minister Donald Tusk's government for its efforts to restore the rule of law in the country. Mr. Tusk, a former president of the European Council, took office in December, pledging to restore Poland's place at the heart of Europe. He started efforts to undo the previous Eurosceptic government's reform that increased political control over the judiciary. But he faces a significant obstacle in President Andrzej Duda, a political ally of the former Law and Justice government who has the power to veto legislation.
World News from the BBC.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles, services for new and used bicycles, is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Good morning. It is 8:06, and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Several Wisconsin state legislatures have co-sponsored a Right to Contraception Act in response to threats on reproductive rights. Bill sponsor and state Senate Minority Leader Dianne Hesselbein will join us. And we'll take a look at the sociology of the Gaza protests with UW Human Ecology Professor Connie Flanagan. And finally, today, May 6th, is International Bubble Artist Day. I'm sure our erudite 8 o'clock buzz audience all knew that, of course. And to celebrate, we'll talk with a real-life bubble artist, Michelle Hackett. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, John Wilson. All that's coming up right after this. 6:12, you're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. For almost 60 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld access to birth control as a fundamental human right. In a trio of cases, Griswold v. Connecticut in 1965, Eisenstadt v. Baird in 72, and Carey v. Population Services Incorporated in 77, the court ruled in favor of contraception rights for first married couples, then unmarried individuals, and finally, for minors. Despite that robust legal precedent, in the court's 2022 ruling in the abortion case Dobbs v. Jackson, Justice Clarence Thomas opined that the court should revisit all three of those landmark contraception cases. Congress attempted to adopt a Contraception Right Act in 2022, 2023, and again in the current session, but federal legislation so far has stalled. State legislators are no longer waiting for Congress, but are introducing their own right to contraception acts in state legislatures around the country. Here in Wisconsin, that effort is spearheaded by Senate Minority Leader Dianne Hesselbein, who sponsored SB 365, the Wisconsin Right to Contraception Act. Senator Dianne Hesselbein joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I apologize. I have a little cold. Hopefully it doesn't sound too bad on the radio, but I am okay.
So far, you sound fine. So
wonderful.
So tell us about why we're seeing this fight move to the state legislatures instead of Congress. What's happening in Congress, and what inspired folks to adopt their own efforts to enshrine in reproductive rights?
Yeah, well, I think what we've seen with Republicans in Congress is just completely chaotic. They're not able to get anything done, and they need, you know, the Democrats' help to do anything. And so we looked at that, and with Roe versus Wade being overturned, we thought, you know, what are they going to do next? So I was happy to support this bill with Representative Lisa Subek because, you know, we have seen the Supreme Court Justice Thomas and then inaction, and we're just trying to protect the rights that people should have.
And can you articulate exactly what those rights are? How are they defined in this statute?
Yeah, just the right to contraception, that the, you know, government won't interfere, pretty much. And, you know, I think if you count on the rights that you have today, the Republicans will take them tomorrow, just like we saw with the abortion bill. So, I mean, I think it's just something that we need to do in the state of Wisconsin to make sure that contraception is available for everybody.
Now, we've seen in recent legislative sessions from the Wisconsin legislature a number of constitutional amendments coming through. And when we think of rights and defending rights, we tend to think of those as constitutional issues. Is there a reason you're looking to do this through a statute rather than a constitutional amendment?
Well, I don't believe the Republicans would put it on a amendment. I don't believe they'd put it on for people to vote on because they know how people would vote, right? They know people in the state of Wisconsin would be voting that people would be able to have contraception because it seems like such a no-brainer. However, they won't do it. So we thought, let's get the bill out there, see if we can find anybody, any Republican willing to talk to us on this issue. And so far, we haven't been as fortunate enough to have one Republican reach out to us.
So no one's reached out. I assume you've reached out to them as well. I mean, but have you gotten any response at all or just silence?
No. On February 13th, we did do a polling motion on the Senate floor where we pulled the bill that would actually let us have a discussion on it and debate it. And that vote was, it failed on party lines, 10-22. Not one Republican would talk about it. Not one would vote to talk about it.
So this bill, will this be live through after November? I mean, or would it have to be reintroduced when the new legislature takes office after the November elections?
Yeah, the bill is still out there until, you know, January, and then we all take office and we'll be, you know, doing it again, right? Because people need to have contraception. They need a right to contraception. It's something simple that we can do for the state of Wisconsin. And we had so many people all over the state contact us about how important it is. We had one woman who came to us, and she, wonderful, wonderful woman at a press conference, and she decided to put her intellectual and disabled and developmentally disabled daughter on birth control because she's worried if something were to happen to her daughter at school and she can't consent. What would happen if her, you know, daughter became pregnant? What would happen, you know, if her daughter was raped? And it was just terrible, absolutely terrible that these parents have to think about these things. but this woman put her daughter on contraception so her daughter would not become pregnant in the case that she was raped. Super important. It's not just, you know, these aren't easy discussions that people need to have, and the government shouldn't be involved in any of these discussions, that these private conversations people have.
And what is the nature of sort of the threat to contraception rights and the rights to contraception? I mean, we know, as we mentioned in the introduction, Clarence Thomas has opined that maybe the court should revisit some of those landmarks. Are there any cases pending, or are there any legislative efforts that you know of to try and restrict people's rights to contraception?
I don't think there are at this time, but I do know that at the State Assembly we have several state representatives who say very troubling things on the floor about contraception and said that, you know, contraception leads to loose morals and sexually transmitted diseases, which is not true. So I think they have some very strange opinions over there. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why we put this forward, because we want people to know that there's nothing wrong with contraception. In fact, it's perfectly normal and healthy.
And talk a little bit about the sort of the historic fight for reproductive rights and what that means for women's rights.
Yeah, so we've seen, you know, I was one of these people, you know, gosh, it seems like so long ago, when people were like, oh my gosh, you know, they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I was one that said, oh, I don't think that's going to happen. I really didn't. I was completely shocked and stunned when that happened. And I just think if they're going after that, they're going after every decision that they've ever made. And I think we have to be ready, and I think we have to make sure that people have their rights. And I think, you know, people are mad. I think families are mad, and they're mad that, and I'm upset that my daughters have fewer rights than I did. And so I think people are going to be remembering that in November as well.
And so this bill, as you mentioned, has got a lot of sponsors. They're all on the Democratic side of the aisle. What happens next with this bill? Is it going to go to hearing, or is that dependent on the Republican majority?
Yeah, so it's actually in the Health Committee right now. Unfortunately, the Senate adjourned for the year, which is terrible because we should still be working. So it's not probably going to get a hearing. They probably wouldn't put it up for a hearing anyway because they know it would be very popular. So it'll just stay out there. We're going to continue to talk about it and see if there's any ways we can approve it. And then in January of next year, we will be releasing that bill once again and explaining to the people in the state of Wisconsin and all over the place that this is important and this is should be a non-controversial, easy vote for people to take.
There's been some controversy from abortion rights advocates who have talked about things like what's commonly called the morning after pill, which some would call contraception, and some would call an abortion alternative. What would this bill cover? Things like the morning after pill?
Yes, it does. So that's, once again, it's also contraception.
Okay. And have you gotten any response from the anti-abortion crowd in response to that particular provision?
No. Once again, it's been really, really quiet. It's been surprising. And I would have thought that some of my Republican colleagues would have, you know, said something or come to the office or said, hey, we like it, but not this one piece of it or something like that. But it has been absolute crickets.
And talk about some of the support that you've gotten for this bill. Who else have you worked with in terms of the activist community or other folks who've helped you draft or work on this?
Definitely. So, like, I was surprised that we had people from the developmentally disabled community reach out because that wasn't something that I thought of when I was drafting it. That, you know, contraception is for everybody, and families that have come forward to say that the right to contraception is so important because they want to plan when they want to have their children. They want to know what's going to happen. And sometimes they have people that have difficult pregnancies or have a lot of different, the medical community is another one that's come forward to say that, you know, contraception helps people regulate their period. It's not just about planned pregnancies or unplanned pregnancies. A lot of the times it's about being healthy. And a lot of people that have health conditions take contraception for a host of many reasons. So it's this, you know, reason why, once again, this is so important to the people in the state of Wisconsin.
All right. We've been speaking with Wisconsin State Senate Minority Leader Diane Hesselbein. You can track the progress of SB 365 at legis.wisconsin.gov. Senator Hesselbein, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And we'll be back with the outdoor right after this. And it's in the air like a firefly, June and July. Light is June and July. I know you're bad for me, but when you say you want me again, want me again and again, I can feel you up on me. It hits me all of a sudden. No, yeah.
You. And oh God, I get so high every time, happens every time. A day, my dear, I focus in my whole time, feeling inside, got this feeling inside. I want you come closer, I feel like
into the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. And every week we turn to master naturalist Paul Noldner to give us an idea of what's going on in the great outdoors. Here's Paul with the Outdoor Adventure Report.
Hi, I just got done nutting a little bee that happened to get in where I'm sitting here giving the report. And hopefully it won't buzz too loudly while I give the report. I'll let it go outside right after. Your weekly outdoor adventure report for May 6 to 12 is brought to you by Madison Fund, Friends of Urban Nature, which is a partnership of Parks, Environmental, and Friends groups connecting communities and kids with nature in Madison everywhere all year round. Outings are free, fun, welcoming, diverse, fairly accessible, family and kid friendly, naturalist guided, and educational. You can come out every week. Outings are free with no registration unless noted. No special equipment is needed to enjoy the great outdoors. Just show up and join the fun. This past week was great for bird lovers, with Baltimore Orioles and other brightly colored spring birds singing in flowering trees all over Madison. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance led walks at Picnic Point to look for spring myrts and at Cherokee Marsh to look for tiny warblers dancing in the treetops. Calling Spring Frogs put on a show with naturalist Jeff Steele. And on an evening frog walk at Cherokee Marsh, and UW Arboretum offered a special bluebirds class with naturalist instructor Sylvia Merritt. Madison historian Don Sanford led a free family-friendly Penny Park history bird nature adventure at Penny Park Beach. BIPOC Birding Club did their great Wisconsin Birdathon Bird Count Saturday, and the pedaling, paddling peewees took advantage of the beautiful weather to do their weekend-long birdathon starting Friday, with 65 excited third graders helping the team find birds on their Better World Day outing at Cherokee Marsh, followed by dawn to dusk birding by the Peewees on Saturday, and everyone on Chuck Hendrickson's spring birding adventure on Sunday helped find birds for a grand total of 100 bird species right here in Madison. You can join the fun with great birding in local parks all year round. Coming up this week, there's more great spring birding, including a trifecta of adventures with the always insightful and entertaining naturalist Alex Singer. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and BIPOC Birding Club are leading a slow paddle birding by boat outing tonight, Monday, May 6th at 5:30 at Cherokee Marsh on School Road to explore the incredible diversity of birds, insects, and aquatics by boat. The event, I just checked, is full, but you can sign up for the wait list at swibirds.org. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and Friends of Cherokee are also leading a free warbler walk on Wednesday. It's coming Wednesday, May 8th at 6 a.m. in the early morning at Cherokee Marsh, meeting at 1000 Wheeler Road to search for warblers in the trees. On Thursday, May 9th, Madison Parks welcomes public input to guide and inform public park policies and facility decisions. You are invited to come to the park's new Lakeside offices at 330 East Lakeside Street on Thursday, May 9, anytime between 5:30 and 7:30 to view ideas and share your thoughts. Seniors are invited to join a nature walk, Senior Bird Nature Adventure, Thursday, May 9 at Warner Park Community Recreation Center, meeting 12:15 in the senior lunch area, to join naturalist Alex Singer for an easy walk outside to enjoy the beauty of nature at Warner Park and wildflowers in Warner Woods. On Saturday, May 11, bird lovers all over the area will descend on McFarland's Bird Festival from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Saturday, May 11, 9 to noon at Lewis Park Shelter, 12 Highland Drive in McFarland. It's a beautiful spot if you haven't been there. There will be booths with information and activities. Enter the prize raffle. Enjoy guided walks at 9:30 and 11. All at beautiful Lower Mud Lake, a great area year-round for bird watching. The event is free and open to everyone. You can see McFarlandLibrary.org for a link to more information. Nature lovers, families, and kids of all ages are invited to join a month of Maying Bird Nature Adventure Saturday, May 11 at 2:30 at Owen Conservation Park on the west side. Birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's fall in love. Join Alex Singer for a free, family-friendly outing to enjoy spring birds, bugs, flowers, and the burst of life occurring around you. You will get another opportunity for a month of Maying adventure with Alex Singer on Sunday, May 12th at 1:30 at Terrill Point, just off John Nolan Drive at the railroad crossing. Free, fun, family-friendly. These outings are welcoming, no registration required. The annual Memorial Day weekend Bird Nature Camp is coming up May 24 to 27 at Lake Lucerne Camp and Retreat. Just north of Madison, there are still some openings for nature lovers of all ages, birders, friends, families, and kids. Be a big kid at camp in comfortable cabins with meals served in a dining hall while you help on bird walks to find birds all over the area. It's a beautiful place. Contact Paul Neldner, P-A-U-L underscore N-O-E-L-D-N-E-R at hotmail.com. For more info and to reserve your spot. More adventures coming up in May include exploring the creek, nature journaling, signs of spring, magic of feathers, frog and toad walk, and the annual bird and nature camp. You can get details at cityofmadison.com parks and tinyurl.com Madison Fun Adventures. And be sure to check out the websites of all of our great local, environmental, and friends of parks groups, creating opportunities to enjoy nature everywhere in Madison. It's naturally fun.
All. And now it's time, as we do each and every week, for the Song of the Week. And John Wilson, what do you have for us today?
Well, I thought I would go back into the archives a little bit, all the way back to 1980 and across the ocean to Japan, to play a song by one of the godfathers of the city pop genre, Tatsuro Yamashita. This was a genre in the late 70s through the 80s in Japan that's, you know, pretty radio friendly and pretty polished, but also, like, frankly, it goes really hard. And this is the opening track from Tatsuro Yamashita's 1980 album Ride on Time called Someday.
It's 8:34. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. On Wednesday, May 1st, University of Wisconsin administrators called in officers in riot gear from the UW Police, State Police, and Dane County Sheriff's Office to forcibly remove tents set up as a protest against Israel's occupation and military operations in the Gaza Strip. Police arrested several at the scene, including students and professors. They used chokeholds and held participants to the ground. Since Wednesday, however, protesters have rebuilt the encampment, and negotiations with the UW administration continue. Protesters' demands include university divestment of funds associated with Israel. The young people's views on Israel and Palestine differ sharply from people of older generations. And we turn now to University of Wisconsin Human Ecology Vaughn Bascom Professor Emerit Connie Flanagan, who has made her career studying youth and politics. Connie Flanagan, welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you, Brian.
So we've seen some statistics from things like Pew Charitable Trust and other surveys that show that people in the ages 18 to 29, what are commonly called Generation Z, have a very sharply divergent view of the situation in Israel and Palestine than people of an older generation. 36% say that that Joe Biden, for example, is favoring Israelis too much, compared with only 13% who are 65 or older. How did folks of this age group develop their political opinions? What forged that viewpoint?
Well, they've certainly grown up in a different era than their grandparents, for sure, in terms also of the relationship to Israel. And that's true of within a lot of Jewish families, actually. There's a generational divide within the very families. So I think the historical era when you come of age and the growing up period for the Gen Z has been very different in terms of this, but in terms of many, many other things. I mean, this is a generation that had to in their classrooms across the United States, you know, deal with gun violence and how to deal with a shooter, like with their teachers. This is a generation of Black Lives Matter. This is a generation that is going to face climate change, whereas their grandparents will not see as much of a devastation to their lives as climate change. So in many, many, many ways, various issues have forged this generation.
And, you know, I sometimes struggle with the sort of concept of generations in that, they're not evenly distributed. If you look at like the baby boomers, it includes a lot more years than, say, you know, Generation X or Generation Z. How much can we attribute? And then is there sort of an issue of masking the sort of diversity of opinion within each age group? How important is age or generation or cohort to political beliefs?
No, you're absolutely right. We really forget the heterogeneity within every generation. But it is the case that, I mean, the whole concept of generation really tries to capture the historical times in which people grow up, and particularly when they reach their late adolescence and young adulthood, because it really is a politically formative time. So where you stand, it's not that you always stand with all members of your generation, because that's impossible. But the fact of major historical events occurring in the time when you come of age does shape your political views thereafter, because you take a stand on something. And although it's always the case that we become more conservative as we age, we see many more sides. We think change takes a long time, because it does, whereas younger people are not as willing to accept that. It is the case that wherever you stand on major issues in your early adulthood has a lot to do with where you will stand later on the political spectrum.
So I let's explore that a little bit. I mean, this idea that, first off, that people always become more conservative as they grow older. What's the evidence for that? I mean, I hear that a lot, but I can think of a lot of anecdotal exceptions, myself included, of people whose, political views have become more radical and less accommodating as they get older. Is there strong evidence to suggest that that's actually the case?
Yeah, I think there is. I understand what you're saying about anecdotes and people that we know, but the national surveys like the General Social Survey or the Monitoring the Future, which is a national study of high school seniors, they have panels that follow people over time. So it's the same people over time that are aging. And so you can basically see for those same people the ways in which they change over time. It's not to say that people don't change in different ways, in more radical ways, in more leftist and more right-wing ways. It's just that on average, the general trend is we have families, we have jobs, so a lot of the decisions about how to take a stand become more conforming. You vote, you get out the vote, but you don't necessarily join the protest because you're thinking about picking up your kids at the end of the day. So there are certain things about social roles that shape the way in which you can take a stand. So you may have really strong opinions. It may just be you don't exhibit them in ways. I mean, younger people, it's not that they don't have obligations. It's just that they see this sort of a clarity of a moral issue, I think, and don't want to listen to the it takes a lot of time to make change, because they see it as such a compelling moral issue.
Now, I mean, speaking of sort of intergenerational comparisons, and there's been a lot of comparisons with some of the protests evolving the Israel military operation in Gaza. And there have been a lot of comparisons with that and the anti-war protests of 1968. When I look at the demands that many of the students are making right now, the comparison that strikes me is one from a slightly later period of looking at the arguments for divestment from universities and others from the apartheid state of South Africa. Can you talk a little bit about sort of those echoes from generation to generation? And how does that, I mean, how are young people influenced by the people who came before them?
I was a member of that 60s generation, and many of us thought we had discovered certain things until we started to read some history. So, I think it's one of those things you educate yourself along the way. One generalization I think I would make is if you look at a lot of social movements, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-apartheid movement, it's really often young people who are leading the way. So if you just take the civil rights movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was more radical than their elders, but they pushed their elders. I mean, they're the ones that took the risks of sitting in at lunch counters. They're the ones that got arrested. It's not that the others didn't, but what they were basically saying, is we have to push for change. We can't conform. We can't wait. It's also the case that, the 60s, the anti-war movement at that time had some differences. There was universal conscription. So that is not, that is not the case today. And you're right that the tactics in terms of divestment is much more similar to the anti-apartheid movement. But I think it really reflects the sort of intelligence of young people leading these things is to say, what is it that we can do? What connections can we make? Where can we push? You know, I mean, to push their universities to say, yes, you're not directly involved here because it's American policy, but you have a role in these other ways. And in some cases, some universities are sitting down and talking to their students. It's also the case in the climate strikes that the divestment issue was used. So it's successfully in many places, I think, including Colombia. So, you know, so the strategies that are at our disposal, you know, vary by what the situation is and what our involvement is in the political issues that we're objecting to.
What is it about universities in particular that tend to create people who are on the vanguard of these kinds of protests? I mean, if you look at it from a right-wing point of view, like, you know, Governor DeSantis in Florida and others have decried what they call woke culture, where people go off to college and they become radicalized and, you know, their parents don't recognize them anymore. Do they kind of have a point in a way?
I would say a couple of things. One is the sort of developmental period. So, you know, in your young adulthood is when you're trying to figure out your life, where you're going, what you care about, what you like, what you stand for, I would say, is in part the values that you hold. So you have people, you have a sort of critical group, age group, and they're all collected together. And frankly, I mean, we at universities pride ourselves in the liberal arts as being a way in which you have civil dialogue and discussions and debates, and you work across differences. I mean, these are skills we think, or we at least used to think, were the ways in which we resolve problems in a democratic society. So universities serve a really important role, not just in sort of the content that they communicate, but the ways in which they develop, I would say, civic dispositions in younger generations. I mean, who are going to be the leaders in the future? It's not people my age. You know, it's definitely the ones that are getting educated now. And what we want is for them to have a chance to listen to other perspectives, take a stand on things, reflect on where they stand and change their mind if they need to, and learn how to find common ground over differences. That's the essence of, you know, living in a common society. You have to be able to do that. And universities are places where we pride ourselves in doing that. You know, that's sort of a lot of the mission statements of our universities. It's a lot of why we say government should, you know, fund us, because we are developing not just future workers, but, you know, citizens that will be the leaders of tomorrow. So you have an age group in a setting where the goal of the setting is to learn how to take a stand and find common ground. I don't think there's any evidence that you get radicalized in college. There may be some truth to you know, the more liberal leaning, but that's not true of all universities. And I think professors make a huge attempt to respect the views and sort of model civil dialogue. So I don't think there's certainly not a reason to cut down on what gets taught or what what we discuss.
Well, and let's hope that lesson gets passed on to university administrators when they think about calling in riot cops. So.
Yeah, conversation is always the better decision. Yeah.
All right. We've been speaking with University of Wisconsin Human Ecology Vaughn Bascom Professor Emeric Connie Flanagan. Connie, thanks so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you, Brian. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with international bubble artist Michelle Hackett right after this.
I wake up, my shoulder's cold. I've got to leave here before I go. I pull my shirt on, walk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. I pull my shirt on, walk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend? I never want to see you again. How am I supposed to pretend?
Are you anticipating the fun and frolic of Wartstock as much as we are? To whet your appetite for that amazing day of music, we've got a pre-fest patio jamboree planned for you on Saturday, May 11th at the Malt House. From 2:30 to 6 p.m., we'll have two folk groups to kick off our outdoor concert season. First up is Annie and the Okies, acclaimed stalwarts of the local bluegrass and Americana scene. Followed by The Firesides, a superb duo from the Driftless area, playing old-timey Appalachian and traditional folk tunes. Admission is free, but donations to the musicians and to Wart Community Radio are welcome. And we'll have advanced tickets for the incredible Wartstock raffle on hand. It's the Wartstock warm-up party at the Malt House, 2609 East Washington, on Saturday, May 11th from 2:30 to 6 p.m.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Rooted, announcing its Troy Farm plant sale on Saturday, May 11th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The plant sale features a great selection of certified organic vegetable, herb, fruit, and flower plants for sale, including some new Southeast Asian vegetables and herbs. Proceeds from the sale help support Rooted's food justice and land justice work on the north side of Madison. More information is available at rootedwi.org.
It's 10 minutes to 9. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Well, as I'm sure you all know, today, May 6th, is International Bubble Artist Day. Joining us now by phone is Michelle Hackett, who is, in fact, an international bubble artist. Michelle will demonstrate her craft at the Madison Circus Base on Saturday, May 11th. Michelle Hackett, welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So tell me, how does something like International Bubble Artist Day get declared? Is there some, you know, international group that decides when something like
there
Bubble
is an
Artist
international
Day?
Group on Bubble Artist Day, and today is
okay.
It is International Bubble Blowing Day. So I'm not sure exactly who declared it. Somebody just told me about it, and I'm like, I'm on board. Let's do it.
And are you yourself an international bubble artist? Have you performed in other countries?
Not yet, okay. But I am part of the International Association of Bubble Artists. And we created a promotional video that's going across the internet today. I posted it on my Facebook page. I'm going to put it on my Instagram a little bit later. And it's got bubble artists from all over the world.
How large an organization is the International Organization of Bubble Artists?
It's pretty big because we're from all over the UK. A lot of the artists are from the UK, but you also have like Meadow Perry, who is in the US, as well as Steve Lang, who runs the Soap Bubble Circus. He's my mentor. I trained with him in 2020. He's absolutely fabulous. But there are all over the United States, there are tons and tons of bubble artists. We're actually having our first international U.S.-based bubble convention in September, which is going to be awesome because there's going to be bubble artists from all over the world, including Tom Noddy, at that festival in Cleveland, Ohio, which is going to be great. There's just going to be so many bubble artists in one place. It's a whole lot of love and joy.
And a whole lot of soap.
that too.
So describe for us, like, what could someone expect from a bubble artist? I think, you know, most of us have blown bubbles in the backyard, and maybe we even got, like, fancy and got some really big bubbles. But you're talking about something a little more elaborate here. What can people expect to see?
So there's a large variety of things that you can do with bubbles, from smoke bubbles to giant bubbles to different devices that we create to make bubbles, to like create like a bubble wall. There's a huge variety of, sorry, feeling a little repetitive, of things that can be done. My show this weekend is going to be an indoor show, and we're going to go through a variety of the toys that I have, including smoke bubbles. We're going to have some bubbles that we add some helium to. We're going to have some really big bubbles. We're going to have some kids come out and actually create some bubbles, because most of my shows are pretty interactive, and it's just going to be a blast. I do a variety of interactive experiences. For example, I work for the in Milwaukee a lot for the Big Truck Days, which is on May 18th. And there we have tables out that kids can come make bubbles at. And last week, I was over at the Bayview Community Center over in Madison, and we have 15-foot wands where we make thousands of bubbles for kids to pop. Depending on where we're at, the situation that's going on, and what people are looking for, there's just a ton of things that you can do with bubbles that people just get wildly surprised at. when I met Bastille Days in Milwaukee, I've done that one for, I think, a couple of years now. What happens is there's a tunnel effect. So I'm making bubbles with my 15-foot wands and the garlands that go across that make like thousands of bubbles. And it's in between like three big tall buildings. So there becomes a wind tunnel. And then you can see a tornado of bubbles just going up into the sky, which when the winds are right, is the most beautiful thing in the world, at least in my opinion. Last year, I was also at the big bubble sculptures that are kind of traveling around right now. They were in Milwaukee in July of last year, and the downtown Milwaukee group, as well as Marcus, helped bring me out for every single day that the bubbles were there during the week of their like big exhibition. And it was great having the bubbles in front of the bubbles. I was like, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But so, basically, you can have a lot of bubble popping and a lot of amazing tricks.
So what kind of fluid or soap or what do you use to create these bubbles? Is there a particular mixture that is preferred?
There's a handful of different mixtures out there. There's some that you can buy commercially. I make my own for my outdoor events, and I use guar gum as my medium. A lot of people in the past have used glycerin, and they've had some good results with glycerin as their additive, but I use Dawn, guar gum, a little bit of baking powder, and some good intentions.
And is it environmentally safe?
I believe so. It's soap. I don't fully understand that aspect of it, but all of the bubble artists that I know have basically said that it's fairly environmentally safe because it's just a basic soap.
So no PFAS or anything like that, is it?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And so do you, as a bubble artist, do you become sort of a amateur physicist when it comes to things like surface tension?
An amateur physicist?
Well, you have to know something about surface tension in a practical way, right? I mean, do you feel like you're learning something?
More as a chef.
A chef, okay.
Yes. Well, I come from a background of cooking. So my family owned restaurants for a good percentage of my life, and I've worked in catering, and I've worked in a lot of things where we've cooked for a lot of people. And every single time I make a bubble mix, I feel more like a chef because I'm feeling it in my fingertips for consistency. A lot of it has to do with like the humidity of an area. So you'll have to tweak your mix based on how humid a location is, and you might have to add more water, you might have to add more soap, but to me it's more like being a chef where you're kind of looking at it and feeling it and deciding like how things are working and then watching how it functions and then deciding what you need to change in order to be able to get it to work better.
And so when you perform an indoor events, like you're performing at the Madison Circus Space on Saturday, what's cleanup like? I mean, if you've got other people using that space, are they worried about slipping on the floor? I lay out a floor. Okay.
And my indoor events, I always lay out a floor. And it's kind of like a big truck garage floor that's got like a non-stick to it. So I try and make sure keep everything on either in one of my kiddie pools, because I make my bubbles like over a kiddie pool that's on this floor, or on the floor, and then I wipe the floor up and then I roll the floor up and then I put the floor away. But a huge part of what I do is prep and break down and prep, because I want to make sure that everybody is as safe as possible and that nobody's tripping and falling and everything like that.
All right, so safe bubbles. We were after.
Yeah,
so
safe,
My goal is to have people not fall.
Okay. International bubble artist Michelle Hackett will perform at Madison Circus Space 2082 Winnebago Avenue on Saturday, May 11th at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, go to bubblelady.ticketspice.com. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our program today. I'd like to thank our guest, Wisconsin Senate Minority Leader Diane Hesselbein, UW School of Human Ecology Professor Connie Flanagan, and bubble artist Michelle Hackett. Thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, who lined up all the terrific guests you heard here today and kept everything running smoothly down here at the studio. Thanks to our engineer, John Wilson, who piloted the mightier-than-ever WORT soundboard. And thanks to our receptionist, Lori Ranney. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, May 6th.
Action Weirdos Productions presents This Week in Music History for May 6th. On May 5th, 1995, Real Big Fish released their first full-length studio album, Everything Sucks. The members of Real Big Fish were in high school when the band formed in 1991. The third wave of ska was in full swing with bands like The Toasters and no doubt getting the attention of major record labels. The energy level on this album is definitely third wave, and higher than that of two-tone ska, trading the R&B influence for faster tempos and distortion. Speeding up and adding crunch to the guitars did not dilute the ska flavor, it distilled it. The horn section is a key flavor in Big Fish's sound, and they use it to give the songs a lighter feel, making the intensity more palatable. Everything Sucks by Real Big Fish is full of energy. It's goofy fun from the perspective of young Americans, and even though it was released in 1995, and although a lot of things have improved, many of the things that sucked back then still suck today. Also this week, May 6, 1994, Pearl Jam files charges against Ticketmaster in a federal court claiming monopolistic practice. The band lost, had to cancel their summer tour, and eventually had to book their next tour with Ticketmaster. May 6, 2005, Starbucks banned the sale of Bruce Springsteen's latest album, Devils and Dust, over concerns about its adult content. May 6, 2013, Lauryn Hill is sentenced to 3 months in jail for tax evasion. That was this week, years ago. The best music is essentially there to provide you something to face the world with.
It's Lomo Maine 2024. You can support local bees and other pollinators by limiting your lawn mowing practices this month. Give pollinators more time to take advantage of the taller grass and native plants and